Okay, so this is my second lecture about K-3 surfaces. And last time I briefly mentioned, maybe in just one sentence, what my ultimate motivation is for giving these lectures, and that is with an eye to constructing manifolds with holonomy G2. So I'm not going to say what that means today, but I do want to briefly give you a preview of what that construction is going to look like, so that you will understand what level of detail about K3 surfaces we need to understand in order to do that construction. So I take a K3 surface S, and I look for a situation in which X is embedded in a in an algebraic threefold, in such a way that X is actually a representative of the anti-canonical divisor of that algebraic threefold. So written in fancy sheaf language, if I take the inverse of the dualizing sheaf, I get OZ of X. So depending on the behavior of the anti-canonical system, typically we would expect to find more than one section, and they should have some nice properties. If omega z inverse is ample, is an ampline bundle, then z is called Fano. And for this construction, we need some kind of weak Fano, which is a little weakening of that condition, and that's something I'll talk about when we actually do the construction. So the construction starts with this natural setting in algebraic geometry of the K3 surface. It turns out that that the canonical bundle of an anti-canonical divisor on a Fano variety should be trivial, and so looking for Fano threefolds with K3 surfaces as anti-canonical divisors on them is a reasonable thing to do. So geometrically, the linear system X, or the linear, the let's see. So I want to let X tilde be the blow up of the base locus of the linear system. Z tilde be the blow up of the base locus of the linear system X. So if you don't know what that means, I look for other anti-canonical divisors, and I try to ask the question, what points are in common to all possible anti-canonical divisors? That's called the base locus, and I blow up this base locus. So that gives me a vibration to P1, and maybe over infinity, I actually just get X. And if I take Z tilde and subtract X, this is it's not projective, it's not compact, it's a non-projective variety with trivial canonical bundle. And in fact, some years after Yao proved his big theorem, after Yao proved the Kolodny conjecture, he proved a version which applies in this situation. So this implies, by a theorem of Yao, not the original theorem, that there exists a metric, a Ricci flat metric, on z tilde minus x, which is asymptotically conical, and although I described subtracting one element of a linear system or one element from P1 in the sort of algebraic geometers way, where I think of P1 as this nice compact guy and it just took out a point, in fact, if you take out infinity from P1, you get the complex numbers, and the asymptote that we're talking about is to go to large complex numbers, and then we're seeing something which, in which the metric is behaving as if it were conical, and in fact, it's a cone. It's asymptotic to a complex cone, a C star cone, over X. So I guess from the perspective of a neighborhood of infinity, it's maybe a little more clear that you might expect to see the thing near that point be very much like x, and this metric is actually asymptotic to that. So there's this remarkable construction called the twisted connect sum construction. First written down by Kovalev. And in the twisted connect sum construction, you take this difference, z tilde minus x, you cross it with a circle, and then you glue it along x cross a 2 torus to another gadget of the same kind with the same x. But the two S1s in T2 are different. And this works to give you something that has almost a G2 structure if x has the same metric but different complex structure. So I mentioned last time, and I'll say it in much more detail today, the story of the S2 worth of complex structures for a fixed Ricci flat metric on the K3 manifold. And what we have to do here is it's a very explicit type of change of complex structure, which goes along with the swap of the S1. So there's a second S1 coming from the fact I mentioned it was a complex cone. So that's a C star cone. That's a real cone with an R over a circle bundle. So that circle is what we're talking about asymptotically. And here I've got the circle, but those circles switch, and you have to change the complex structure while keeping the same metric. So we have to have enough control over K3 surfaces to, first of all, read off something about when the K3 surface was contained in a final threefold. What do we know about its Hodge structure and its periods and so on? And then how do we make this change of complex structure? And when we do that, how do we recognize whether this K3, which was algebraically contained in a different final threefold, is the same one that has the same metric but with a different complex structure? So I'm going to be spending a fair amount of time sort of talking about identifying the complex isomorphism type of a complex K3 surface and or when they have the same metric. And ultimately, we're going to be applying it to this situation. So I'm not going to say anything more about this twisted connect sum today. And depending on how fast today goes, maybe not next lecture either, but at some point I'm going to give an entire lecture about this. And there's an analytic step after this in which you, which I certainly won't try to do anything about, in which you show that given this approximate G2 holonomy structure, there is an actual G2 holonomy metric, which is closely approximated by this guy. There's some epsilon in the gluing, and you can use that epsilon to control the degree of the approximation. In fact, something on the order of 500 million families of examples have been constructed this way, and so we want enough control that we can maneuver around that collection of 500 million families. And ultimately, actually, I'm interested in generalizing this to cases where X might have some mild singularities itself, which is actually important for the applications to physics. But anyway, that part is coming later. I just want to give a little explanation of why I'm going to be so concerned with the details of K3 manifolds. So what was a K3 manifold, a K3 surface? So it's Kähler. I'm putting that in as an assumption, although, as I mentioned last time, historically, that wasn't one of the defining assumptions. It's got complex dimension 2. It has a nowhere vanishing holomorphic 2 form. And it has no holomorphic 1 forms. So for every holomorphic of any holomorphic 1 form, global holomorphic 1 form is identically 0. And this turns out to imply, with a fair amount of work, that pi 1 of x is trivial. And in fact, something that I forgot to mention last time, all such x are diffeomorphic. So we can speak of one underlying differentiable four-manifold, the K3 manifold, and then think about metric structures or Kähler structures and so on this manifold. And then the metric structure was for each Kähler class. So that's a class of a Kähler form in H2 Durham, X real. There exists a unique Ricci flat metric in that class. So that's a consequence of Yau's proof of the Kolobi conjecture. And I just want to briefly explain why there's a choice of complex structure as a result. So this one is called capital omega, and the Kähler class is called little omega. The reason that there are multiple complex structures is that the real part of omega, sorry, I should say the span of the real part of omega, the imaginary part of capital omega and little omega inside of H2 Durham XR is a maximal positive definite subspace. I remind you from last time that the intersection form on H2 has signature 3, 19. So these are all positive, and they're a maximal positive dimensional subspace. And any phi in SO3 can be applied to this subspace without changing the metric. So how do you draw conclusions like this? Well, these Ricci flat metrics are have the special property that their holonomy is reduced from SO4 to SU2. So that means that when you do parallel transport along paths in this manifold, and it's a simply connected manifold, so I don't have to worry about the distinctions on holonomy which arise if it's not simply connected. If I transport vectors along paths, obviously if I have a closed path, a loop, then I get back to, so the metric was preserved all along the parallel transport, and so I have to get back to something which is in the SO4 orbit of the original vector, but the special holonomy property says, in fact, it's much more strongly constrained than that. I'm in the SU2 orbit of my original vector for some choice of complex structure on the tangent space. And you could work out then how the representation theory of SO4 on the second cohomology works, and you learn that there have to be, in that situation, these three completely invariant two forms. And it's the subspace of invariant two forms which is the canonically determined thing, not the individual ones. So the way to do this is to take any vector of the same length as omega, take its orthogonal complement, make an arbitrary choice in that orthogonal complement of an orthogonal pair, which we're going to use to be the real and imaginary parts of capital omega, and then build the capital omega by putting in an I, and that turns out to be the pair of forms, the holomorphic two form and the Kähler form, that would define another compatible complex structure on the same metric space, Riemannian metric space. So anyway, that's the variation of metric that I'm talking about. On the other hand, if you're starting in algebraic geometry and you want to know something about these K3 manifolds, then a more natural thing to do is something that I introduced last time, which is to look at a basis, to choose a basis of the second integer homology. And I told you all these guys are diffeomorphic, and I mentioned last time that as a Z module with quadratic form, this is isomorphic to three copies of the hyperbolic plane. Lots of people have different notations for hyperbolic plane, so I'll just write it out like this, plus two copies of the lattice, the negative definite lattice, which is associated to E8, and so just to indicate that I'm changing the sign with respect to the standard positive definite sign, I'll put the -1 there. So there's an even unimodular lattice of signature 3,19. In fact, up to isomorphism, that's the only even unimodular lattice of signature 3,19. So I'll choose a basis for that. And then I'll integrate my holomorphic form over the basis vectors. And because a holomorphic form is only well-defined up to a complex conjugate, yeah, you might have wondered, what about the complex conjugation? So, of course, not complex conjugation, multiplication by a complex number. If I multiply omega by a complex number, I'll do a rotation of the real and imaginary part together with a scaling. So it doesn't change the span whatsoever. And here, in this version, I'm simply going to think of this as living in complex projective space. This is 22. Complex projective space, because of the possible scaling, all the periods would scale the same. They can't all vanish, so I can think of this as being in complex projective space. And in fact, there's a little more information. If I call this pointed projective space V, or the linear version of a V, then V intersected with V has to be zero, while V intersected with V bar has to be positive. And that defines a this defines a quadratic hypersurface in P21, non-degenerate, and this defines an open set in that quadratic hypersurface. So I get a description of all possible periods as a complex 20-dimensional space, which is an open set inside of a quadratic in CP21. So this is a very concrete way of expressing what's going on. You could imagine taking some example K3 manifold, somehow working out what the basis for the first homology, the second homology was. That's not so easy in practice, although I think I mentioned last time that somebody actually worked out a sort of CW complex description of the K3 manifold, which lets you do that in principle, although the pictures, which are printed in a journal in the days when graphics were not quite as good, I stare at those pictures and I try to understand what it means, and it's a little hard. But anyway, in principle, it's just within the realm of computability to work this out. But in practice, we actually use indirect methods to figure out where we are in this period domain, and what K3 surface we have. Right, so what is there a question? Yeah.
So this period domain represents all the possible K3 surfaces?
It represents all the possible K3 surfaces, but so it represents K3 surfaces with a choice of basis of H lower 2. So it's like a Teichmuller space in the Riemann surface.
Then
I have to divide out by something. And in fact, there are a few technical complications in the dividing out, which I'm sort of getting to at this point. That's right. So I've, in order to realize it this way, I've actually chosen a basis, and then I have to worry about the automorphisms of this thing acting on that space, and what is represented if I do that. So what I've actually described here is a Hodge decomposition of the second complex cohomology. So there is a Hodge decomposition of the second complex cohomology. It's the subspace spanned by the holomorphic 2 form, and then you've got the complex conjugate of that spanned by the capital omega bar, and then in between you have this guy H11 complexified, and the simple thing to say is that H20 is the complex span of omega. And by specifying the periods, I've said where that subspace is inside of the 22-dimensional complex space H2. So this is canonically the projectivization of H2x complex with complex coefficients, right? So I've said where the one-dimensional space is by picking out this point. And then the H02 is just the complex span of omega bar, and H11, this is H11 complex, is the, so I'll write it this way, H20 plus H02 complex conjugate. So for understanding how the so-called hot structure of the K3 surface behaves, the only data that I really needed was to say where that H20 space went, and that's the data that's specified by the classical periods for this guy. So here's what one would wish. One would wish that if you're given two complex K3s, okay, so there was an old term, it's a term I kind of like, which is the term Kählerian. So this was back in the day when we didn't quite know that all K3s were Kähler, so it's a little superfluous to say it now. But what I mean is, it's a K3 surface that's known to have Kähler metrics, but I'm not going to tell you, I'm not going to pick a Kähler metric. But anyway, all the complex K3 surfaces, we now know have that property. So if I'm given two complex K3 surfaces, each with a chosen basis, of H lower 2, okay, maybe they have to be called X and Y. Well, I'll still put each with a chosen basis of the second homology, and an isomorphism. Well, what should I require of the isomorphism? It should preserve the Hopf structure. And it should preserve the intersection pairing, the quadratic form on this guy. So it's an isomorphism phi, let's be consistent about notation. It's an isomorphism, little phi, from H2 X complex. Well, let's see. So it should really be an isomorphism. It's preserving the integer structures. Maybe I'll write it as an isomorphism on H upper 2. H upper 2, there's no torsion here, it doesn't really matter. And when I say preserve the Hodge structure and the intersection pairing is after tensoring with R, and the Hodge structure is after tensoring with C. So the wish would be that this implies that there exists a capital phi, which is an isomorphism, such that capital phi upper star is little phi. So that's what I wish was true. And it's almost true, but we need a little bit of extra information. So that is the similar statement for elliptic curves, which I was running through last time, tells you that an elliptic curve is characterized by its periods. And last time I explained a very concrete way of seeing that using the theory of elliptic functions. We don't have that tool here, and this the version of the theorem I'm about to say is called a global Torelli theorem for K3 surfaces, and it required more complicated tools to prove. The first version was a purely algebraic version, then extended to the complex case, and then later versions actually rely on Yau's proof of the Kolobi conjecture to take some shortcuts and give a more sort of efficient proof of the global Torelli theorem. But I do have to introduce two other pieces of information. So the first piece of additional information is I want to define v plus of x let this be the component of the set of kappa in H2XR such that kappa paired with itself is positive, the component of that containing Kähler classes. So, most of us are much more familiar with quadratic forms of that are positive definite than we are of indefinite cases. In the positive definite case, if you ask for the cone of positive vectors, then there's just one component of that cone. It's a connected space. But in the indefinite case, there are two components of the cone of positive vectors. And so I have to choose a component of the cone of positive vectors. Can I just remind you of the standard, you know, hyperboloid of two sheets or whatever, this picture in real geometry, which explains why there's this disconnected issue. So I'm really doing positive, so I don't include the boundary, the cone just the interior, and there definitely are two connected components. So if I had an isomorphism, it would certainly have to take the corresponding cone for x to the cone for y. And then the second piece of data that I want to look at is going to be called delta plus of x. And that's going to be the set of classes in, okay, so I have to say what delta of x is. Well, maybe I don't. So it's the set of delta in H2XZ intersected with H11 of x real with the property that delta is the class of an effective curve on x. So what does this mean? If I have an effective curve on x, C on x, then there's a cool formula for the self-intersection of the effective curve. The self-intersection of the effective curve is, I'm assuming that this is an effective irreducible curve. And the self-intersection of an effective irreducible curve is 2g minus 2, where g is the genus of the curve. So that follows from the adjunction formula and the fact that I've got trivial canonical bundle on the surface. So actually, there are really no problems with respect to preserving the positivity of intersection pairing if I intersect a Kähler class with some class delta whose self-intersection is non-negative. But the cases where the self-intersection is negative are potentially an issue, as I'm trying to explain, and we'll explain further within the next few minutes. So the key case to focus on is c squared equals minus 2. And it turns out that if c squared is minus, well, so in the rational case, I'm going to get a curve of self-intersection minus 2. So then it turns out that given any delta, so putting it in H2XZ is what is certainly a requirement if it's going to be the class of, this is the Poincaré dual class of an algebraic curve. And then classes of algebraic curves always have Hodge type 1-1. And then there's the Hodge conjecture, which says that the classes which are in HPP and also integral are supposed to be classes of algebraic subvarieties. In codimension 1, which is what we're dealing with now, that's known as the Lefschetz theorem, and it's true. Given a delta like this, it will be represented by some algebraic class, but it might be a linear combination of positive and negative things. But what's true is that plus or minus delta is the class of an effective divisor. And that fact here follows from Riemann-Roch. So I can't sort of do all the details in lecture of some of these things, but that's a kind of key ingredient. On the other hand, if I have a Kähler class, then the Kähler class should have positive intersection with effective curves. So a Kähler class is going to pick out which of those are plus and which of those are minus. In other words, I want to pick out some subset of these classes with the property, some subset of these algebraic classes with the property that is the class of an effective curve. And I'm really not sure why, but delta of x by the way, for part of this lecture, I'm following a paper called Some Remarks on the Moduli of K3 Surfaces. And sorry, I can't give you archive numbers and things like that. Because it's from 1983. But if you look on my webpage and go to publications, you can find it easily. I wrote it. So we can define delta of x to be essentially delta plus of x intersect the set of delta such that delta squared is minus 2. So those are the classes which potentially are the effective rational curves. And it can be shown that that delta of x is generated it can be shown that if delta 1, delta 2, and so on are the irreducible rational classes of rational curves, classes of irreducible rational curves, then for every delta in delta of x, delta is a combination ni delta I with ni greater than or equal to 0 and an integer. So it generates it in this sort of way. So we're going to come in a couple of minutes to some more things about the structure of delta, but let's see. So my wished for theorem I can actually now state. So I had an isomorphism which preserved the Hodge structure and preserved the intersection pairing. And what I also want is that phi maps v plus of x to v plus of y so that I get the correct component. And phi maps delta plus of x to delta plus of y. So I need to preserve these two extra things. By the way, the necessity for this is again obvious. If I know the class of effective curves on x, and I have an isomorphism, then their images will be the effective curves on y, and so these constructions, those cohomological constructions, would have to agree. Then there exists this isomorphism, capital phi, x to y, with the property that capital phi upper star is little phi.
Can I ask a specific question?
Sure.
What is an effective curve?
Okay, so it's a curve. So if I have an irreducible curve on x, if I have any curve on x, typically C can be written maybe as a union of various components. And if I think of this as actually a subscheme of dimension 1, then those components might have some kind of multiplicity, components with some multiplicity. And that leads to a notion of what are called divisors. So I really should have called it an effective divisor. It's dimension 1, which is why I sort of slipped curve in on you. But divisors are just formal linear combinations of irreducible curves. So there's kind of this dictionary that one makes between algebraic subvarieties of codimension 1 counted with multiplicities and linear combinations like this where the multiplicity you put in as a coefficient, and those multiplicities are all non-negative, but you can take in the theory of divisors, an arbitrary linear combination of CIs with both plus and minus coefficients, and that's the sort of thing that you would recognize as being both an integer cohomology class and of type 1-1 if you didn't know which ones were represented by actual curves. So what I want is to pick out the things that are represented by irreducible curves. This picks out, even that doesn't pick out the irreducible ones. I want things which are represented by combinations of irreducible curves, possibly with multiplicity. That's the technical thing. So I said too many words in algebraic geometry to really answer your question. I know I didn't answer your question, but that's the best I can do at the moment. Sorry. Okay, so this is no longer a wish, it's a theorem. It's called the global Torelli theorem. And I might call it global Torelli a la Burns Rappaport. There are various versions of the global Torelli theorem. Burns and Rappaport are the ones who did it in the Kähler case rather than just the algebraic case, and this was essentially their statement. It's a slight reformulation of their original statement. So So what I would like to do is to take that period domain, that thing which sat inside as an open subset in a quadric sitting inside of P21, and I would like to mod the period domain out by an orthogonal group. It's basically the orthogonal group which preserves that choice of component of the, I'm just going to introduce the shorthand, lambda 319 for the for the isometries preserving this guy. And it's roughly correct that this is this parameterizes the points, but you have to be a little careful about the delta plus stuff, right? So that plus sign is sort of handling this V plus thing, but the delta plus still has to be thought about. So there are various technical issues with respect to this guy. And the technical issues sort of all revolve around delta plus. So I want to explain what happens if you put in a Kähler class, which actually helps you keep track of things. And that was actually the point of the paper that I was writing, was to put in a Kähler class. It was an odd thing to do in algebraic geometry at the time, partly because if I wanted to discuss a moduli space and include Kähler classes, I would have a kind of mixed real and complex moduli, and nobody really knew what to do with that. What I didn't realize was that I should have complexified my Kähler class, which physicists later taught us, and if I'd done that, maybe we would have seen the connection to things going on in physics a lot sooner than we did, but anyway, I didn't do that. So if I have a choice of Kähler class now, so what's the Kähler cone? What's the notation for the Kähler cone? Okay, I'll make one up because I can't find it quickly. So I'm going to use a sort of capital kappa for the Kähler cone, and that will be the set of all classes. So I'm going to write the class in the form class of omega. Okay, that makes it sound like I already know it's a Kähler cone, but I'm just trying to write down the cohomological conditions. So that should be maybe I should use the letter. The problem is I want to use a lowercase kappa, and I already have capital kappa. Capital kappa doesn't even exist in text, right? How can you use any symbol that doesn't exist in text? So it's the kappas in V plus of X with the property that the pairing of kappa with delta is positive for all delta in, it turns out it's enough for all delta in delta of X. I don't need the delta plus of X. That contained all the rational curves. I'm copying the notation from my old paper. I don't really like it at this very moment, but I'm just going to use it. For all the delta in delta X. So remember, these were, this was delta plus of X, intersect the set of delta whose self-pairing was minus 2. So I have to put in this condition because if something is represented by an effective curve and I have a Kähler form, that the integral of the Kähler form over that curve has to be positive. So that's the condition. And you see from these conditions that Kähler cone has to be preserved by this kind of abstract isomorphism. And of course, we would expect the Kähler cone to be preserved by an actual isomorphism between the two K3 surfaces. So that's the Kähler cone. And now you see that there are points in this period domain. So there are points in D which do not represent There are points in D, and I need to draw a picture. So V plus was this nice connected cone, which was things that I wanted to use as Kähler classes. And if I have anything in delta x, the things in delta x are going to describe, so these are hyperplanes where kappa dot delta is equal to zero. So I can either be on one side or the other side of such a hyperplane, and that's going to slice the cone into pieces. So if I take the family of cones, if I take the set of the V pluses over this period domain D, you might have thought that that was going to be equal to the set of, up to isomorphism, the set of K3s. I need the marking, of course, but I also wanted to choose a Kähler class. And that fails exactly if you hit this wall. So that's not quite true, because kappa is not allowed to be in any of these walls called delta perp. Now, the general K3 surface, general complex structure on K3 surface, has no deltas. So delta of x is empty, or maybe zero, empty, I guess, for the generic point. And so I don't have to worry about this issue, and I get this nice correspondence between the, I get the Hodge structure from the period point, and I get from all this other data, I see where the Kähler cone is. And that actually tells me where all the metrics are. But if I'm on the wall, then I sort of have a problem. So what does it mean to approach the wall? Well, it means that we have a limiting family of Kähler classes with the property that the limiting class has some, for some curve, so I can write this a little bit better. If I took the limit of those Kähler forms, I would find that the integral of on that particular curve of the, that limiting Kähler form was equal to zero. So it's not a Kähler form because it's given area zero to a particular curve. But there's a beautiful thing in algebraic geometry which you could do, at least if the set of such curves is finite. So if I had a finite set of such curves, I can blow down those curves to points, p1 to pk, and obtain a space that's not quite a manifold, but it's a space which has controlled singularities. I'll say a little more about what those singularities are, but it has controlled singularities. And you might hope that perhaps there was some version of Yau's theorem, some version of a theorem that would give you a metric on those spaces with controlled singularities. So that's something which I essentially conjectured in this paper that that I'm telling you about, and was proven a few years later by two guys named Kobayashi and Todorov. So Kobayashi and Todorov showed that there's a way to modify Yau's proof, and there exists a Ricci flat orbifold metric, so-called, on X bar. So I have to explain what that is and explain what that means. But that gives me a way to include back these points which are on these walls. But then you can ask, well, what's the difference between the K3 surface on one side of the wall and the K3 surface on the other side of the wall? And again, there's some really pretty geometry and combinatorics associated to that. Namely, associated to delta of x, which is my collection of effective rational curves, delta of x determines a reflection group. Which I'm going to call W of x. So all you do is impose the reflections in these various elements delta. That reflection group is going to take, so when I've chopped up my Kähler cone into various subregions, right, that reflection group is going to take region to region to, it's going to preserve all of these separating hyperplanes, and so it permutes all the regions, and it turns out to act transitively on the regions that you get. So this acts transitively on the Kähler cone minus the union of delta in delta of x of these delta perps. So I've chopped it into a bunch of pieces, and then they're acted upon transitively by this reflection group. So up to using reflections as well as isomorphisms, I get a one-to-one correspondence between the data that I had written down for my Torelli theorem and the points modulo some appropriate automorphism. I should point out that this W of X is actually a subgroup of O plus lambda 319. So when you're taking the quotient, these identifications are made automatically. And in fact, that subgroup has fixed points. And so what we're doing is sitting at a place which is fixed by that W of X. And it's natural that you get some kind of orbifold structure. Well, sorry. That's true, but irrelevant. There are fixed points. And so when the dust settles, you end up describing not exactly D, but the bundle of V pluses over D as having this natural action O plus lambda 319. And if you mod out by that natural action, you will get the set up to isomorphism of pairs of K3 surface with the complex structure chosen and also a Ricci flat Kähler metric. Thanks to Yaz there. I've been going kind of fast. Are there any questions or is it hopeless? Okay. I think it might be hopeless, so I will press on. Sure.
So these are what we're getting are the analogs of when we do like the upper half of Planck quotients?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So the D kind of represents the upper half plane. I needed to supplement it by a Kähler class. In the case of elliptic curves, the only Kähler classes are a real half line, and so there wasn't really any extra data here. I could have imagined doing it, but I would have learned nothing by doing that. So the kind of algebraic geometry problem, as I mentioned before, is going to be if I have my X somehow described geometrically in terms of some Fano variety. Typically, that Fano variety is going to have line bundles or Kähler class on it, and I'll restrict those to X and generate some known classes in H2XZ intersected with H11R. And as I vary the K3 surface on the Fano threefold, I'll get some collection of K3 surfaces with some fixed data like this of one or more line bundles, depending on the geometric details of the guy. So the metrics that I'm interested in on the K3 surface are metrics in typically cohomology classes that are represented by these guys. So these are actually going to be classes in the Kähler cone of X. And then I can do things to try to evaluate information about the periods. For example, there is a beautiful method to approach the calculation of periods for K3 surfaces, which is to use the following idea. If I had a family of K3 surfaces, depending on a parameter T, and I calculated these various, and moreover, I chose a family of holomorphic two forms, depending on T as well. So these can be thought of as holomorphic two forms on some fixed underlying differentiable manifold of which I've chosen a homology basis. And if I differentiate with respect to the parameter, it turns out that this guy, when restricted to T equals zero, lives in H20. So it started out in H20 because that's what was represented by capital omega, but it lives in H20 plus H11. And if I differentiate it a second time, I get into the entire space. And if I differentiate it a couple more times, I'll end up finding a differential equation, usually calculable in terms of the data on Z, a differential equation which must be satisfied by the periods. And that's often enough information to locate the family of periods that I'm discussing. In a case like this, where it's a one-parameter family, I actually get an ODE, and you could do power series solutions of the ODE, and those are telling you some nice collection of points in this projective space, and you could sort of go to town learning something about the behavior of the periods. So although I presented it rather abstractly, in the context that we're going to be applying it, some K3 surface obtained algebraically, there are going to be ways of getting your hands on the data algebraically. The other ingredient that we'll be using, as I mentioned, is changing the compatible complex structure. So what I would have to do in a case like that is to take my real part of omega, my imaginary part of omega, and my little omega. So my little omega is this integer class that I'm talking about here, right? It's coming from some line bundle on the ambient space. And I'm going to want to swap that with, for example, real omega. That's the type of transformation I'll have to do. So I have to look at cases where real omega is also represented by an integer class. So that I've got a two-dimensional integer sublattice sitting inside my positive three-dimensional space. And that provides the beginnings of analyzing this problem of how do I find these pairs of K3 surfaces which can be matched up in that particular context. So what I just gave you a description of, this set of V plus of X's, this bundle of V plus of X's sitting over D, that and then modding out by O plus of lambda 319, that corresponded to the set of pairs, well, let's see, set of X's, a set of isomorphism from H2XZ to lambda 319. I have to choose an isomorphism, and then I have to have a Kähler class. Right? So, I took care of the isomorphism by this. So, X's and Kähler classes, effectively. And what I've just explained is that the metric only depends on the corresponding three-dimensional subspace. So I can kind of map this to the three-dimensional subspace. And I just want to describe fairly briefly the version of this story which works for those three-dimensional subspaces. And again, the lattice delta of X will play a role in describing what's going on there. So I'll describe that, and then I'll tell you a few things about delta of X, but I don't think I'm going to have time to tell you too much about it today. I'll have to do that next time. So I'm essentially taking my H11 of XR, and I'm decomposing it as the span of the class of the Kähler form plus the orthogonal complement of the class of the Kähler form, right? So it's a direct sum like that. And then I'm taking my H20, which I can think of as if I take H20 plus H02 and intersect them with the real cohomology, that's the span of the real part of capital omega and the imaginary part of capital omega. Just a fancy way of saying that. So the three-dimensional space that I care about is it's this H20 plus H02 say, plus the real span of omega, all intersected with the real cohomology. So there's a natural map from this bundle of V plus of X's over D to, so what I've done here is specified a three-dimensional space which is on which the form is positive definite inside of the 3,19 signature space. So that's the Grassmannian, the positive Grassmannian of three planes, positive three planes, inside of R319. And I should say that the one thing I left out of this was the volume. So here is the volume with respect to the metric omega. So it turns out that if you just look at the topological construction that I've been discussing, this is an isomorphism. This, all I need to do is to describe the real three plane. And obviously the group that I'm talking about, O plus of lambda 319, acts naturally in this space. It acts trivially on the volume, and it acts on this Grassmannian part. And if I look at the delta of x, and in particular, if I look at the delta perps, the union of, that set of hyperplanes I had a minute ago, the union over delta in delta x of delta perp, that's going to correspond over here. Well, to say that delta was of type H11 meant that it was orthogonal to both the real and imaginary part of capital omega. That means it's orthogonal to capital omega, but it's a real number, so it's orthogonal to both the real and imaginary parts. And to say that it was in delta of x, or rather this set that I sort of wanted to leave out at a certain point to talk about Kähler cones, was going to be the ones in delta x, which were the Kähler class, the putative Kähler classes, the ones in V plus of x, which were orthogonal to all of the deltas. So this goes over to the set, again, of delta in, and now I'm just going to say delta such that delta squared is minus 2 of the corresponding delta perps. So if I'm on such a space, such a point, then I'm sitting at a point where delta represents a real class, plus or minus delta will be effective, but of course the delta perp doesn't care whether it was plus or minus. And the thing that I wanted to use as a Kähler class has intersection number 0 with delta, so it's not actually a Kähler class, but I can use that blowdown trick. I don't know where the blowdown went. I can use that blowdown trick to generate a sort of singular K3 surface with controlled singularities which would correspond to such points. And those points turn out to exactly be the set of fixed points of any of elements of the Oth plus lambda 319. So if you have an element of Oth plus lambda 319 with fixed points, then it turns out that the fixed points are in one or more of those delta pluses. So the picture here, and now just referring to the metric, I can give a sort of better story of the thing. The picture here is that if I have a Ricci flat metric on K3 on a K3, then to it I can associate the space of harmonic self-dual three forms. Span of that space, or the set of those three forms, is a subspace of H2XR, and that gives me a point in this positive Grassmannian of positive dimensional subspaces in R319. To think of this as a point, I have to choose a basis. So if I choose a basis, I get a point like that. And then if I have these Ricci flat, and this is minus the union of delta such that delta squared is minus 2 delta perps. Right? So they're not in there. But if I take a Ricci flat orbifold metric, on an X bar, well, it's a little less direct because I don't really know how to talk about the harmonic self-dual three forms exactly in that case. You have to be somewhat careful about it. And H2 of the singular space is smaller, so you have to have an embedding of that singular space into the larger one. Another chunk of that paper is about those technical issues. But the basic point is that to this I can associate a point in this union of delta perps. So I get this complete space that describes all the possible Ricci flat metrics on both the K3 manifold and some orbifold versions of it in limiting places. The group action has fixed points along those orbifold points, and if you're coming from an algebraic geometry situation, you can sort of explain this in terms of the algebraic structures on the K3 that you started with. Okay, so a few words about the structure of these delta perps and so on. So if I have that limiting situation, so if there exists delta such that kappa delta is equal to zero. Then the set of these deltas spans a finite dimensional space. It's, in fact, the set of deltas, and this was also delta delta equals minus 2, set of such deltas is finite for a fixed kappa. So if I have a point that I thought was going to represent a Kähler class, but it's not quite representing a Kähler class because there's a collection of two spheres, rational curves, on the manifold which are being shrunk to zero size, turns out that there's only a finite collection of those guys. And they, if you look at connected components of these, you'll discover that each of them, so a connected component of such a set of deltas, delta 1 up to delta k, this has an intersection matrix with the following properties, that the self-intersection of any delta j is minus 2, and the intersection number of any pair of them is non-negative if j is not equal to k. So, a little combinatorial problem. You've got a finite number of things whose self-intersection is minus 2 and whose off-diagonal terms are greater than or equal to 0, and it's supposed to be a connected collection, which we'll see the meaning of in a moment, means there's no submatrix that you can form which has absolutely zero interaction with the other, with the complementary subset. That combinatorial problem with the sign changed is the problem of this completely equivalent to classify what are called simply laced Dinkin diagrams. So, in the course of classifying Lie algebras, semi-simple Lie algebras, one gets down to this Dinkin diagram thing. The intersection matrix in that case is not necessarily symmetric. So, putting on the extra condition of a symmetric intersection symmetric matrix. Is what the simply laced adjective is about. But then you have this sort of combinatorial problem, and people have solved it many, many times, and it turns out that it's the same combinatorial problem here. And the answer is that there are two infinite families, A, N, which has... what I'm drawing is a vertex for each of the C's or deltas and a connection when they have intersection number plus 1. So all the intersection numbers are plus 1 or 0. And a connection when there's an intersection number plus 1 and no connection otherwise. There's Dn, which looks like this. And then there are the exceptional ones, E6, E7, and E8. Which look like this. So, where are these configurations of curves on K3 surfaces coming from? It turns out that these configurations of curves are actually are described in complex geometry in the form of a singularity C2 mod gamma, where gamma is a finite subset of SL2C. And okay, finite subgroups of SL2C are double covers of finite subgroups of SO3, and the corresponding guys are called cyclic. These are all binary because you have to take this double cover, but it's binary dihedral, and then it's binary tetrahedral, binary octahedral, and binary icosahedral. And somebody, probably John Cannon, left me demos. Okay, here's the octahedral group, and here's the tetrahedral group, and here's the icosahedral group. Okay. So there are these three sort of stories. One is the story of finite subgroups of SL2C. Another is actually you can work out what the structure of the complex singularity is that you get by this quotient. That's another such story. If you blow up that singularity, if you look for a way to resolve the singularity as we do in algebraic geometry, then you find a configuration of curves that looks like this, and that's the same configuration of curves that you see in simply laced Dicot diagrams. So this ADE classification sort of ubiquitous, it shows up in lots of places, and I think that, so, and just to recap, if I were at such a place, then the types of singularities on the limiting K3 manifold are orbifold singularities, or quotient singularities like this. There's a well-defined notion of an orbifold metric. It means one which at the orbifold point looks like locally it came from a metric upstairs taking the quotient. And that's the kind of metric that Kobayashi and Todorov extended Yau's theorem to, so that we know that there are these nice limiting Ricci flat orbifold metrics on this other collection of spaces. So I will stop there for today. Any questions? Okay. That's not a good sign.